Microphone check. 1, 2, 3. City. Sibilance. Levels check. Good. Sounds good. 1, 2, 3. Rolling and...
The most important thing is that you have the trust of the people that you're filming. They allow you access to things that, you know, as an outsider, you would assume they might want to keep hidden.
I don't let myself drown into a situation where I'm not capable to film anymore because maybe I'm feeling too emotional or stressed. Intimate personal feelings usually come after the filming.
Hello and welcome to The Documentary Life, a show that sets out to inspire and inform you on how to best live and lead your own documentary life. I am your host, Chris G. Parkhurst, and this is episode 102, and it is brought to you by the DocLifer Elite Mastermind, an exclusive weekly mastermind where filmmakers come together for support, guidance, and empowerment to make their best doc films and lead their best doc lives. Last week, I talked about how when I went to Cambodia to work on a current doc project, Elvis of Cambodia, I was constantly bogged down physically and mentally with the sheer amount of gear that I was always traveling around with. If you haven't listened to it, I'd recommend maybe going back and listening to our first episode of Season 2, Episode 101, since it's the first in our 9-part series that we're doing called Chris in Cambodia. This is part 2 of that series, where we'll take a look at, among other things, how to be essential when making your gear choices, in particular when doing film work overseas. And at the end, as a bonus, we'll tell you where you can take a look at my essential doc film gear list. So with that, let's go back to December in Rochester, New York, where it's snowy and cold. I'm packing my gear for my big annual trip to Portland, Oregon, where every year I take part in a big 3-week corporate video gig that I've been doing for years. One of the weeks usually consists of a whirlwind 3 or 4 day shooting tour in 5 or 6 different cities in the Pacific Northwest and the Southwest of the U.S., some combination of Seattle, Portland, Boise, Salt Lake City, Phoenix, San Francisco. They're often on the docket for said whirlwind adventure. I'm usually one man banding the operation or taking my friend and colleague and boss, Michael, with me on these trips. These videos, they end up getting used at the annual conference that this big-time independent copier company puts on every year for its employees and spouses. And by annual conference, I do mean rock and roll show extravaganza. If you've ever been lucky enough to participate in one of these types of events or produced video for this kind of thing, it's partly a meeting that looks at the company's yearly numbers, partly an excuse to party on the company's dime, and partly an excuse to make some really good money making some videos that no one will ever see beyond the day of the event, which, by the way, is probably best for all involved. I've gotten to know many of the employees for the company throughout its branches. I love working with Michael, and I love making some money at the end of the year and beginning of the new year. I've only missed one of these gigs in the past 8, and that was because I was in Cambodia when we were first working on Elvis. Which brings me to what I was doing 2 days after the 3-week gig ended, going to Cambodia to work on Elvis. Which is what was making packing so damned tricky. Not only did I need to pack for shooting for 3 weeks on this job, but I'd also be packing for then going to shoot in Cambodia. If you guessed the climate in January in Portland was different from January and February in Cambodia, well, you guessed right. So, along with making sure that I had all of the necessary gear for both major but entirely different shoots, I was going to need to be smart about what I packed for clothing. But for the purpose of this, I'll try and stick to what I packed for gear, which, as you already know from last week's episode, turned out to be too much. But you know, to be fair, I was packing gear from 2 entirely different shoots. So as I was packing for the corporate gig in America, I was also packing for the passion project in Cambodia. So my initial approach was to take out my pad of paper and pencil and jot down the types of equipment that I was going to most certainly use for both shoots. And I suppose it's worth noting that at least in America, I knew that I had accessibility to whatever I might need should I be in a jam on one of those shoots. I had plenty of film industry colleagues in Portland, and of course, there's always the trusty B&H or Amazon if I needed something shipped quickly. Which actually brings me to one of the pieces of gear I knew that I was most definitely going to need for both shoots. Lights. Now, I owned a set of LED light panels that I'd been using for many years. They were packed neatly into a big carrying case that was pretty easy to check in. However, these were purchased probably 6 or 7 years ago. They were still very heavy. LED technology had come a long way since then. They're now smaller, lighter, use less power, and yet put out more luminance. Like those flexi LED panels that are out there now. Yeah, now that made sense to me. Why carry around this heavy bag of 3 light panels when I could pick up a few of the flexis, which I could easily stow neatly into some other bag? And the price on these flexis were quite reasonable. I was going to make good money on the corporate gig, and these would be pretty packable and lightweight to travel around with. So I made the spur-of-the-moment decision to leave my old LED panels behind, making a mental note to sell these later on to help defer some of the costs of the new ones, and I bought a few of the flexible LEDs and had them overnighted to my initial destination in Portland, Oregon, where I had the first of many shoots. Good, that was easy. What was next? I looked around me at my pile of gear, trying to decide what else would be absolutely necessary on both continents. Well, certainly sound, right? But the question was, which lavs, shotgun, and or external recorders to take? Now, this is a tough one for me. I generally like to try and pack as lightly as possible. I know, that's not what I said last week, but again, we must take into account that I was packing for 2 very distinct shoots. I generally try and pack lightly, but I also generally try and have some kind of backups with me. If you've been a longtime listener of the program, you would know that I've been burnt before, and in nearly catastrophic fashion. It was in Nepal, on my dock journey to Kathmandu, when, during that first week, my primary camera, and by primary, I mean only camera, it died on me. I was very fortunate to be able to find a Nepalese dock filmmaker who rented me a camera that was quite comparable to the one that I brought with me. I basically lucked out, though. There were definitely a few days there where I truly thought my ship was sunk before it had even managed to leave the port. Since then, I try and bring some kind of backup of major equipment with me. It doesn't have to be exact backups, but something that will at least get the job done adequately should a mishap occur. This time out, as a primary camera, I had our Canon C300 Mark II. My backup plan was our old Canon 70 DSLR. Sure, a far inferior option to the C300 Mark II, but it could work in a pinch. But going back to sound, I was bringing a Sony wireless lavalier, but also I had a Sony wired option, should the wireless go down or run into any kind of interference. Actually, a little secret here. I try and use the old, archaic-looking wired lavalier option whenever I can. In this way, I don't ever have to worry about interference, but I also kind of like the sound a bit better. Plus, if you don't have a dedicated sound person, it allows for you to have one less thing to worry about, in this case fiddling with the sound. A wired option, it allows you to simply run your XLR between your subject and your camera, put on your headphones, check your levels, and you should be good to go. So I survey the room at my belongings again, and I start gathering more of my essentials and some of their backups, and I begin to start putting them into bags. Now, one thing I want to mention here about packing bags is that I highly recommend getting a couple of those really big duffel bags that you can usually find in an outdoor store like an REI. Make sure, though, that they're not oversized bags. You know, make sure and check travel allowances for your airlines. But you'd be surprised at the dimensions that you can actually get away with. What this means is that you can stow something like your tripod in one of these big duffel bags. Your tripod and its protective case, it doesn't have to be a separate piece to check in now. You get to pack it into the duffel bag along with other pieces of gear. Just make sure that you're weighing your bags before you head to the airport. You don't want to end up being one of these people who ends up trying to shuffle items in and out of bags up at the check-in counter because they're not making the weight limits. So there's this really great little device I use. It's a digital luggage scale. I always travel with this, and it allows me to instantly weigh my bags. Basically, you hold the scale in your hand, which is attached to a belt that you loop through your bag. You pick up the bag, and voila, it tells you the weight of the bag down to a tenth of a pound or kilogram. That thing has saved me many a headache and dollar. It's Tuesday, January 22nd of 2019, and I've just finished up with the marathon of a job. I'm at the airport, getting ready to finally embark for Cambodia. I'm at the checking counter, and I'm loading my bags to the belt. I'm smiling to myself as all three bags that I check in come in just slightly under the maximum allowable weight for the flight. After paying the exorbitant fee of $200 for the additional bag, I sling my small backpack over my shoulder. This backpack has my passport, tickets, laptop, and drives. And I grab my other carry-on bag, which contains the camera and lenses. And I grab my other carry-on bag, which is a roll-on, which contains the camera and lenses, and I make my way to security. Now, I know that a lot of you probably check your camera gear in at the counter, but I've just never been able to bring myself to do that. Most any job that I've ever been on, you know, where I've been freelancing, they've all put all of the camera and lenses in big protective Pelican cases to travel. Of course, the production company carries some hefty insurance, as do we, but still, I personally, I've just never felt comfortable being disconnected from my camera. So for years, I've been rolling, literally by the way, with this really cool case made by Think Tank that looks like any other carry-on luggage, which is part of the beauty of it, right? Only it's specially made for camera gear. Inside, it has removable Velcro sections and padding, so it'll fit most any medium-sized camera and a lens or two. I swear by this thing. I make my way to security, already secure in the knowledge that all of the other bags that I've been toting around for the past month is now out of my hands, and will hopefully magically show up on the other side of this trip. In this case, Phnom Penh, Cambodia. I can't help but smile again. This is what I've been waiting for weeks to do. No, that's actually not right at all. This is what I've been waiting a few years to do. Get back to Cambodia, and back to the film that I love working on. As I inch closer to security, I get my tickets and passport to hand. And the dream becomes the reality once again. Thanks for tuning into part two of our Chris in Cambodia segment. As a sort of supplement to today's story, I've written up a special blog post called My Essential Doc Film Gear List that goes into more detail about some of the exact gear that I highly recommend you consider bringing if you're planning on going on a similar film trip in the future. And you can easily find that article by going to thedocumentarylife.com/blog. Next up on TDL, I'll be highlighting this week's Doc Lifer story, and that will be followed up by our conversation with filmmakers James Jones and Olivier Sarbeil, the duo behind On the President's Orders, a doc in the middle of an impressive film festival run, including just this past week where it played at Hot Docs. That and so much more coming up next here on The Documentary Life. Something I wanted to mention before continuing on with today's show. You've probably noticed that we're playing around with some pretty cool, fresh sounds on this season of TDL. And I'd like to thank Musicvine for supplying us with those cool, fresh sounds. If you're interested in learning a little bit more about how Musicvine might be able to serve your doc project, you can check out the show notes for today's episode, or you can simply go to their website at musicvine.com. Hey Doc Lifer, Chris here. You know, when I look back on my documentary filmmaking journey, I can see that I did a lot of things wrong. But I also did some things right, and one of those things was joining a mastermind. I have found masterminds in both my personal and professional life to be extremely motivating and beneficial. I have invested in myself, in my goals and intentions as a filmmaker, and received exponential results. Masterminds give you direct access to like-minded, supportive, and experienced people who get you. They understand what you're trying to do and why, and can help you achieve your filmmaking goals more efficiently and successfully. They can make your whole filmmaking experience much more enjoyable, lucrative, and empowering. That is why I'm so excited to be announcing our first ever DocLifer Elite Mastermind. DocLifer Elite Mastermind members will meet every week for a live group coaching call led by myself and Steph, as well as have access to a private members-only Facebook group where we can be in daily contact. It'll be you, me, Steph, and a handful of other doc filmmakers giving guidance and advice, keeping you accountable and answering your questions on funding, distribution, building a team, your doc lifestyle. Basically, anything that's holding your film back or can move your film forward. Each and every week, we'll be guiding you to greater success and empowerment with your film, as well as working through personal or lifestyle challenges that may be holding you and your project back. For more information and to submit your application, go to thedocumentarylife.com/mastermind. Once you're approved, you'll get immediate access to the exclusive Facebook group and to our live group coaching calls, which start on Tuesday, May 7th, where we can begin to help you take your doc film and your doc life exactly where you want it to go. We'll see you there, Doc Lifer. Welcome to our second ever Doc Lifer Stories. In the spirit of connectivity and togetherness of the documentary filmmaking world, which is the essence of why we started the TDL podcast, we are bringing you stories from Doc Lifers, doc filmmakers like you and I from around the world. If you're interested in contributing your story to Doc Lifer Stories, we'd love to hear from you. Simply write to us at chris@barongfilms.com. Your contribution will help to foster the TDL mission of building a supportive and networked community of doc filmmakers throughout the world. Today's Doc Lifer story comes from a professor and filmmaker out of Virginia. His name is Josh Davidsburg, and he is not only one of our most active members on the TDL Community Facebook group, but he is also an enrollee of our online doc filmmaking courses platform, and he is one of our longtime listeners of the show. When asked what Josh had learned about doc filmmaking that he wished he'd known before, he responded with this: "I wish I had started the fundraising earlier. I went out and just started shooting. I am fortunate that I have a job where I have the time to shoot side projects, and I am expected to do this. I think that was a blessing because I could afford to go out and start on my own, and a curse because I didn't think through the budget, so I didn't raise money for post until later on. I edited on my own, that was always my plan, but I needed money for music and audio engineer and color, which I still may do on my own. I also needed money for E&O insurance. I kept putting it off until the absolute last minute because I didn't really know what I was doing. We raised about $20,000 through crowdfunding and individual donations, but I think I could have raised more through grants if I'd started earlier. I only wish I had known what was fair use and what would be copyright infringement. Near the end of the edit, I found a really good lawyer who came on pro bono, but I was really stressed about it earlier. We were following drag queens who lip sync, so I worried we'd have to pay a lot of money for their music or cut it out completely. He and another lawyer in the firm watched the film, researched the music, and assuaged my fears, verifying that because it was occurring naturally, it would fall under fair use. I probably would have shot some scenes slightly differently if I realized that from the beginning." To read more of Doc Lifer Josh Davidsburg's story, you can either go to the show notes for this episode or go directly to thedocumentarylife.com/blog. This is where current and all future Doc Lifer stories live. Check it out and do consider contributing your own Doc Lifer story today. I am joined by filmmakers James Jones and Olivier Sarbiel today. James Jones is a two-time Emmy Award-winning and five-time BAFTA-nominated director. His films are broadcast around the world, primarily on the BBC, Channel 4, and PBS's Frontline. Olivier Sarbiel is an award-winning French documentary director and Emmy-winning cinematographer based in London. Before turning his lens to film, Olivier worked as a broadcast cameraman in television news. Over the past decade, Olivier has covered conflicts and critical social issues across Asia, the Middle East, Africa, Europe, and North America. The Emmy-winning Mosul was his film that he co-directed alongside with James Jones. Sarbeel and Jones again teamed up on this year's feature documentary on the President's Orders, a doc that takes a look at the drug war in the Philippines, produced with the cooperation of Frontline PBS, Arte France, and BBC Storyville. Gentlemen, welcome to the Documentary Life. I'm very excited to be speaking with the both of you today.
Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you.
And we'll start with you, James, first. I'd love to hear how the both of you, how you guys first got involved filming conflict overseas, and why was this sort of subject genre, if you will, of documentary, why was this appealing to you?
So I guess I would say that I fell into, you know, conflict or kind of tougher situations abroad completely by accident, really. My interest was journalism and then increasingly filmmaking. But I started off making kind of observational verite documentaries about kind of social issues at home. So
yes,
homelessness,
right.
Or yeah, as you mentioned, suicide in the military.
Yeah.
And I guess like as my ambitions grew, there were stories around the world that became possibilities through working with kind of international broadcasters. And I did a film about North Korea, which is obviously not an easy place to make a film about. And kind of off the back of that, somehow I started getting, you know, pushed more towards, you know, difficult places and difficult stories abroad. But I mean, hopefully still retaining the kind of observational, you know, character-driven approach to storytelling that I'd had before. But it was completely by accident. I've never kind of presented myself as a kind of war junkie, frontline kind of guy, but just that it just kept happening. People would, you know, the next suggestion would be a film that happened to be somewhere.
And how about yourself, Olivier?
Well, I have a different background. I'm actually coming from the news world.
Yeah.
So I start my career pretty late, actually, in 2010. And since 2010, for several years, I have covering mostly social issues and conflict, war in Iraq, Libya, Syria, Central African Republic, Mali, Ukraine. I have also a military background, actually. I used to be a Marine paratrooper, but I've always been very passionate by the pictures. That is my first passion. And conflict came a bit naturally for me. I want to link my passion for the pictures and the experience that I have in the army. But again, like James, you know, I don't really like to be called a war reporter. I'm also not a war junkie. I have been seriously wounded in 2011.
That's right.
During the war in Libya, during the battle for Sirte. I spent 8 months, 9 months in a military hospital and lost a part of my right hand. But it didn't took away my passion for the lens, for filming. And it's only 2 years and a half ago that I start to turn my lens to longer format, to documentary.
So there's obviously a lot of crossover between your interests and your passions and the type of work that you obviously currently do, but some of the work that you have done in the past. Where and how did you guys first meet?
We get asked this a lot. And certainly when we first met, we didn't think that we'd spend the next 2 years basically in the same room or in the field together. But we met, Olivier just got back from Mosul on the front line, filming with the Iraqi Special Forces.
Yeah.
And I just finished a doc about police shootings in America. And basically there was a slot that PBS Frontline needed to fill for a short film. And I just got a text on a Saturday saying, hey, do you want to come in and edit this great material we've got for a couple of weeks?
Oh, wow.
And I thought, yeah, why not? And then, you know, the footage was unlike any war footage I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
Really. It was just like extraordinarily beautiful, you know, really intimate access. The soldiers kind of forgot that Olivier was there. And so we cut this like 20-minute film. And I think all of us thought, you know, this was Olivier's first time making, you know, even a something that long, but I think all of us felt that this had the potential to be something, you know, more substantial and, you know, maybe a feature or whatever. And so I kind of came on board initially as like a producer to kind of, and then Olivier went back out to the front line. And then, you know, so we were kind of figuring out how this would work as a longer film. And then Olivier and I went out and interviewed all the soldiers together, most of whom actually were sitting there kind of covered in bandages, having been wounded. You know, half the people Olivia was with were killed or injured. And then, you know, so somehow our skills kind of complemented each other, and we didn't want to throttle each other at the end of the process. And we thought, you know, what subjects could our talents kind of lend themselves to? And, you know, the story in the Philippines, Duterte's drugs war, was something we've been following for a long time. And so as soon as the edit for Mosul finished, we got on a plane out to Manila to figure out, you know, whether it would be possible.
And, you know, James, I can see you, one can see very quickly how you would be taken by Olivier's cinematography. It's as you have suggested here, that there's an intimacy that you don't often see in this type of frontline-esque material. That's really quite stunning. And I'm speaking for both Mosul as well as, of course, the current one on the president's orders. Speaking of front lines, you guys are often, you know, kind of on the front lines in the work that you're doing. I think I'll ask you first, Olivier, working on the front lines, how has your military background helped you in your documentary filmmaking on the front lines?
If we're talking about the Philippines, obviously, even though, you know, sometimes it was a bit stressful, but we cannot compare it to a battlefield situation, to a war zone. So obviously the challenge is totally different. I guess one of the first thing is to build the relationship with the people we have met on the field, especially, for example, in Mosul, the soldiers. I think it's helping me to win the trust of the guy on the ground because they know I was in the army. It helps me, obviously, because I know how those guys move. I know how they think. I know how to interact with them. But to be fair, you know, when it comes to war zone and conflict, it doesn't matter how experienced you are. You know, anything can happen, and it happens to me in 2011 in Libya. But definitely a plus. And again, in the Philippines, when we met our character, and maybe we'll going back to it later, it was also helpful to have that background. You know, they kind of gave, like, for those guys some sort of respect, and the fact that I've been wounded also helped me a lot, you know, show off the scars a little bit.
Is that something you did early on to kind of ingratiate yourself amongst them?
Yeah, I always do it.
Yeah,
not with everyone, obviously, but with those type of character, with those guys, I think it was one of the things to do just to get the trust, to win the trust of them.
دیگه کشت بعد سرجی کرد با گلکی شولجی چه کرین گلکی چه که اقتصاب آوان کرین
James, let's talk a little bit more about this idea of trust. Of course, it's ever so critical in any sort of documentary film endeavor, but you know, how do you, I guess, what is some of your approach when you're working in these sort of conflict areas or on the front lines, if you will? What is sort of your approach to gaining trust of your subjects? And also in that answer, talk again about the importance of that in these films.
So, I mean, it's something we think about a lot. You know, all the films that we do, if they're observational and kind of character driven, the most important thing is that you have the trust of the people that you're filming. They allow you access to things that, you know, as an outsider, you would assume they might want to keep hidden. And it's a slow process. But I've always found that the most crucial thing is actually being straight with people, you know, and not coming across as kind of smarmy, not trying to trick people. And generally, people respond well to that. You know, don't pretend this film's going to make them a star. Don't pretend you're only going to show the good things. You know, I did a film about, like I mentioned, a police shooting in the States in Virginia.
Right.
And we'd filmed mainly this police officer had killed two unarmed young men exactly 4 years apart. And we'd filmed the whole murder trial basically from the perspective of the victim's family, sort of trying to get justice.
Yeah.
And then basically at the end of the process, the opportunity arose for us to meet his wife and to potentially talk to him. And now, you know, I could have gone in there and said, this film is about how great the police are, how it's such an impossible job, and we want to understand it from, you know, totally from your perspective.
Yeah.
But that would have been a lie. And I think people are smart enough on the whole to pick up on that. And so I had to say to them, the reality is this film is going to say bad things about, you know, your husband or you know, you.
Wow.
But it will be a more fair, better film if you guys take part in it. And you will be happier with the end product.
And how was that response?
I was shocked. So we first met the wife, and she obviously had a lot to get off her chest. And so she did the interview, felt like we'd asked, you know, reasonable questions. But then I guess the surprising thing was then we met the police officer who completely felt he'd been wronged by this whole process of being charged with murder for basically what he thought was doing his job. And again, you know, we'd spoken to his ex-wife, we'd spoken to his ex-boss, we knew lots of stuff about his history that was going to be in the film. He'd seen us in court with the families of the victims.
Right.
And so we just had to say, like, this film is happening and it is about you. And so, you know, it's going to be better if you can answer for yourself and help people understand your perspective. And because we were straight with them, and I remember there was one awkward moment as we were about to start the interview with him, which we never thought would happen. And he said, you know, I really hope you're not playing us. And I had a terrible moment of guilt thinking, oh God, are we playing them? You know, but actually we weren't, you know, the film was critical of him, but he still hasn't watched it. He went to prison, but his wife watched it. And because I'd warned her about all the bad stuff that was going to be in there, she liked that. She liked the film, you know? And I never would have thought that in a million years.
Yeah.
And I think that taught me a lot, I think, because if you're straight with people about your intentions and you don't pretend that you're just doing a PR job for them, but you know, you bond with them, you have something in common with everyone and you find common ground and you sympathize where they deserve sympathy and you're just kind of a decent human with them. People do trust you, and that's when you get the best stuff. They let their guard down, they're natural, they allow you to film stuff.
You know, James, along those lines, I mean, I'm curious what your opinion and what your sense is of other doc filmmakers. And I mean, and we're going to get into a little bit of generalizations here, so we can be careful of that. But I'm curious what you feel like in general. Do you feel like doc filmmakers set out to be honest and truthful in a similar fashion to begin with? Or do you feel like we as doc filmmakers all tend to have a tendency to... We have a tendency to have our own agendas or an agenda for a film. What's your general sort of feel about doc filmmakers in that case?
Yeah, I think there is a danger sometimes when doc filmmakers are tackling subjects that are sensitive or controversial and they're dealing with real people's lives, that they can allow their agenda or ambition for the film to get the better of them. And, you know, they're not trained journalists, they've maybe not experienced in dealing with that particular subject matter. And for me, that is problematic if, you know, the film that you end up producing is radically different from the one that you propose to your contributors. I come from more of a like current affairs background, although, you know, hopefully the films in style are very much films documentaries, but still have that like grounding in you've got to be straight with people. And, you know, and interestingly in the Philippines, we had it where, you know, they must have known that we wanted to make a film about the murderous drugs war. You know, we went to the absolute hotspot epicenter of Duterte's drugs war that had been in the news because they'd been caught basically executing a teenager. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was no point in us pretending that we wanted to glorify the cops, and, you know, but there are ways of being honest with them, but still establishing bonds. Like Olivier said, you know, they were really impressed that Olivier had been on the front line in Iraq.
Right.
You know, they liked the fact that Olivier knew about guns and motorbikes and stuff like that. So over time, we found common ground without ever pretending we were there to do a PR job for the police.
Absolutely. You know? And that's a big part of the beauty of a film like this. And I think doc films in general, because it gives us an opportunity, you know, often, you know, whether it's through the media or through education or whatnot, you know, we tend to have, certainly our worldviews can be shaped in a certain way. And what I appreciate, because a lot of the work that I do tends to be in developing countries, particularly in Southeast Asia. And one of the things that I really try to do with my films and the work, including the actual approach to the work, is I want to try to understand cultures in a way and be able to show that in a way, or even an event, or, in your case, something that's happening in current events in the Philippines, to be able to show it in a light that's maybe not normally seen. Not intentionally to show it in a different light, but I guess it's a long-winded way of me saying our thoughts can be shaped easily by something certainly like the media, right? And I find that going to the source and actually trying to discover it on your own and meeting directly with the people that are being talked about, nine times out of 10, you really end up leaving that sort of experience feeling that, wow, there was a lot more complexities here, a lot more to the story than I was being shown. And certainly you guys are doing that with On the President's Orders.
I think that's exactly right. And one thing that we're asked sometimes is whether we see ourselves as activists. And I think both Olivia and I don't particularly like that term being applied to us. We're journalists and filmmakers. I think the term activist implies you go into a situation with a closed mind.
Totally.
And maybe you ignore those nuances and complexities that you mentioned. And that's not to say that the film at the end doesn't have a powerful message.
Yeah.
And activists may want to use it as part of their kind of campaign or whatever, and that's fine. If we've shone a light on it, then that's great. And I think that the Philippines film is important because we did get access. But I think the fact that we're not activists, we're journalists and filmmakers, made it easier for us to get that access in the first place, because we went in there just wanting to film as much as we could, get to the heart of it, get inside these guys' heads. And I think had we gone in there with an agenda just for it to be completely, having made up our minds before we started rolling, I think it would have been quite a different film.
The Philippine leader has faced criticism for launching a drug war in his country.
Pag sinigaw nga ating pasabihin niya, pag user kay puser ka.
We all know already who these people are.
Sino tanad natin kasama?
Drug watch list is a report that these people are using drugs. Why not let them understand the consequences that will happen if they'll continue these things?
So the film that we keep alluding to here is the current film On the President's Orders. Olivier or James, I think it would be appropriate at this point to give us a little peek into what the film is about, and then we'll start discussing the specifics of it.
Yeah, so basically we've been following the phenomenon of Duterte's drugs war, seeing these incredible photographs of dead bodies on the streets night after night. But we kind of felt that the story had become a bit formulaic. People weren't, you'd see a dead body, you'd maybe see a crying family, but you didn't really understand how the killing was happening, how the people who were doing the killing could justify it. So we set out to kind of get access to the police to understand how they thought this was acceptable and to understand, the mechanics of it. And also to humanize the victims' families more than they were being. It was just to see them endlessly crying, it starts to just kind of wash over you. We wanted to kind of understand their lives a bit. So basically we got access to Calaocan police in Manila, which is like the hot spot, the epicenter, which had been a very controversial spot for these kind of killings. And we spend the best part of 6 months filming with them and going on operations, filming them, in their downtime, drinking beers by the beach, and generally kind of getting inside their heads, to the point where at the end of the film, near the climax, when we kind of ask them about these killings that are happening, because basically the film starts and they promise to stop killing. So it's like there's a new police chief who promises to, clean up the police. They're going to stop killing people in the drugstore. And then as the film goes on, you realize they've stopped doing it in quite such a brazen way. They're not doing it in uniform, but perhaps it's gone underground and the killing's still happening.
And I've been following the Duterte story for quite some time. I think I mentioned early on in the conversation that a lot of the work I do tends to be in Southeast Asia, although I have yet to have shot anything in the Philippines. Duterte himself is, dare I say, an absolutely fascinating character. And But, you know, it, and it feels like a particularly prescient time to be talking about these heads of states and the effect that's happening in these countries. You mentioned this idea of access, and you both can kind of speak to this. I'm hopeful that you will. Access is critical for something like this. And I'm curious, how did you go about initially gaining access, certainly, you know, to the police force in the town? Like, this is... it's extraordinary the access you have. And were there ever moments, you know, where they were, I guess, talk about the process of gaining that access. And then I'm curious, you know, how, if they were ever concerned that the people that they might be going after would ever be tipped off by having a film crew such as yourselves around.
Sure. Olivier, do you want to answer that one?
You can start it. I will continue.
Okay. Yeah, so basically we came on a recce to Manila, and we, you know, we'd heard of Caloocan. Actually, a local Filipino journalist told us about Modaquio, the new police chief, being a big character. And she said, you know, there's a chance he'll let you film. And we thought, because it was such a controversial time and such a controversial place, we weren't optimistic.
But then, I'll bet.
And then, you know, we thought he'd laugh at us, frankly.
But oh, yeah.
We showed up in his office, waited 15 minutes, and then started talking to him. And just immediately, he said, yeah, you can film. And it was, you know, it's that perfect combination of, like, ego and vanity.
Yes.
That meant he loved the idea of us flying halfway around the world to make a film about him. And, you know, it was never formalized. It was never... We never had permission from the superiors, but
wow.
So we were always dependent on his kind of say-so.
Yeah.
But from very early on, we were allowed to do whatever we wanted. So then it was just a case of building the trust with the individual officers. But Olivier, do you want to add something?
Yes, and you said it already. We never had an official authorization from the press center, from the police. We knew that if we were going by the press center, we would probably have someone watching our back and probably have a deadline and might be able to film for a couple of weeks. Mm. And we will not be able to get that more intimate access.
Right.
So it was at some point, I think we were able, we spent so much time with them in a police station.
Yeah.
And I think we were able to come in and out. No one will ever ask us for our paperwork,
right,
for our
right.
ID. We could just go to the police station, to the jail, to the SWAT team, to the office of the commander, and just wait for hours and, you know, being friendly with the people, getting the trust. And nobody was bothered about our presence. Actually, people were completely forgot about us, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, like lots of films, there was a lot of waiting around.
Right.
and I guess, like, responding to your second bit of the question, that the fact that we didn't have written authorization made us nervous because, you know, Modaquio is a kind of hot-headed guy.
Yeah.
We could have showed up one morning and he said, actually, do you know what?
We're done.
You can't film anymore.
Yeah. That's it. We shut you down.
We said the wrong thing or whatever. So there was that nervousness. But there was actually only one moment when the police themselves got worried about something we'd filmed, and it was basically they were busting like a cockfighting, and it was like madness. It was like a cartoon. There were like chickens and feathers and everything flying everywhere, and people running in all directions. And then one of the officers pulls out a gun.
Yep.
And Olivier was filming as he did that, and he didn't shoot the guys who was running, but, you know, he got the gun out. Ooh. And they kind of freaked out about us having filmed that, which was weird given that all the stuff they'd said and done on camera. But, you know, we just said, no, we're not going to delete it.
Yeah,
and that was that. So it was, you know, it was a case of just like feeling our way a little bit. But, there was never any sense that they were kind of controlling what we could and couldn't film it. They were pretty, pretty open on the whole.
So, okay, along those lines, Olivier, I would love to ask you, you know, how you are feeling, and this isn't in some very specific moments in the film, how were you feeling, Olivier, being a European, a non-Filipino, you're wielding a camera while a Filipino man is in front of you, utterly distraught, and it's in particular, I think it's the Jimmy Ausa's arrest, and you're wielding a camera, and it's pointed directly at him as the police are searching his house, you know, all the while sort of holding gun, you know, at gunpoint, they're essentially searching his house. He even looks at the camera a number of times. I'm curious, in these moments, how are you feeling and what's going through your mind during these moments? And what, if any, what is your responsibility as a doc filmmaker? And then again, how are you feeling being a European filming these moments, filming a Filipino man in this instance?
Well, I would say intimate personal feelings usually come after the filming.
Mm.
So when I film, I usually create a space between me and the character, the people that I film.
Mm.
I'm here to film. The emotion can come later. I don't let myself drawn into a situation where I'm not capable to film anymore because maybe I'm feeling too emotional or stressed. So I need to create that space when I film, really.
Yeah.
I have been filming in so many countries all over the world. Sorry, I've been living in Asia actually for 17 years.
Yeah.
I was living in Thailand. And I think sometime as a foreigner, as an outsider, I don't mean that it makes the things easier, but sometimes the connection, it's different. I don't know if I make clear, sorry, because my French sometimes is, my English sometimes is not very good.
It's okay. I just got back from working in Cambodia 3 months with a French cinematographer, so I'm fine.
No, sorry. So yeah, no, what is most important for me is to film what's happening. You know, I'm here to do a job. I'm here to be the witness. So right. I need to get the pictures. Always have compassion for the people I'm filming.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying my best to not be too intrusive. The space I was filming was very, very small. You know, that was, you know, there were like 5, 6, 7 cops around us.
Oh, yeah.
Plus the other people from the family. So I saw him watching the Lancer a couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought that moment was so important. You know, when I was wounded in 2011, one thing that was important for me is to have that pictures. A friend of mine take the shot of me when I was wounded.
Mm.
And I thought for me to have that pictures was actually very important.
Mm.
And, you know, I kind of think that Jimmy Hossa was probably happy that we were around, to be honest. I think things could have turned much more complicated if the foreigner, the Westerner, the film crew was not there.
Yeah, yeah.
And somehow, I don't mean that, you know, we change, you know, the film crew change the destiny of Jimmy Hossa.
Yeah.
But we know for a fact, and James can tell you what happened before we arrived to the house, before just a moment before the arrest, where when one of the guys of the special operation team was nearly ready to shoot the guy.
Oh boy.
James, can you explain maybe?
Yeah, so about a week later, when we went on a kind of away day with the special operations unit, one of the officers let slip to us off camera that he'd been the one who had grabbed Jimmy, who'd basically jumped off the roof, and he'd grabbed him in the alleyway before. Yeah. So we were just behind, we were kind of running up to the house, and he had his gun to Jimmy's head. Whoa. And he looked to his boss and said, you know, can I do it?
Oh.
And the boss said no. And he thought that was probably because we were about to show up with our camera. So which is kind of chilling. But yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. And I think both of us wanted to be, you know, we're filming people in really difficult, stressful, unpleasant situations often. And so there's never a simple answer. You know, I think there's a balance between being respectful to their space and feeling like it's important to capture the reality of what's happening. So, you know, similarly in the jail, you know, we're filming people and the jailer starts hitting them with a stick, that's horrific. But equally, it feels important to show that this is the reality of what it's like to be in a Filipino jail, you know. But that doesn't mean it's not uncomfortable and we don't kind of think about what our presence there means and all those things. But it's, I think, like, as a filmmaker, particularly as someone who's not from that country, you just have to be really conscious of these things at all time and understand there's not a simple answer. You know, obviously, if your presence is making a situation worse, then you have to really think, is it worth me being there? But
right.
I think on the whole, we thought that our presence wasn't making it worse, and, you know, it needed to be documented.
Thank you, James. And Olivier, just to kind of double back on what you were saying about this idea of, as a shooter, having a separation between yourself, having some space between the lens and the subject, It's something that I am always consciously aware of as a shooter myself. Now, I haven't worked in direct conflict zones. I'm almost always operating in post-conflict areas, most recently in the case of Cambodia, you know, post-genocide. And what I have found is even, you know, the types of in terms of separation, when an event is happening on camera that may be, well, maybe a fairly sticky situation for the subjects that are involved, I'm able to have the removal in that process. I want to honor the moment. I want to honor, you know, what I'm filming at that moment. But it's interesting. I actually have less of a, I'm less equipped to do that. I tend to, emotion tends to get more in the way during the quieter moments, maybe, dare I say, even a formal moment where I'm having an interview with a subject. And I always have found that interesting, that sort of when I'm filming in action, I have no problem with what's happening in front of the lens in terms of keeping my emotion out of it and honoring that event. But sometimes during the actual interview process, that's where I do sometimes emotions kind of can kind of get in the way. And I wonder if you guys have ever experienced that. Maybe you have, James.
I think that's a really interesting point. And I think Olivier and I are probably slightly different in that way, in that Olivier is amazing at kind of making himself invisible. Yeah. He becomes a camera, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not about the interaction between him and the contributor.
Right.
Whereas like when I've been filming myself or doing interviews, as you say, it is more about that interaction. So you're there, you're there as a human, not just as a camera. Mm. And so that, you know, I've often cried when I've been filming stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
And
I think that's okay in certain circumstances. I think, you know, for the type of like verite filming Olivier does, it's an amazing skill that he can kind of disappear. And that takes like total focus, but it's different. And yeah, I think in an interview, when you are emotionally engaging with your contributor, it would be very strange if you weren't emotionally affected. You know?
I agree.
There's something else that I'd like to add. I'm not someone that like to rush filming. Like when
that's obvious.
Yeah, so
that's obvious in your cinematography.
So when we go to a scene, when we meet people, sometimes I don't even have the camera with me yet.
Yeah.
You know, I always take the time and like James said, I'd like, you know, being invisible. And to get there, you know, I need to feel the connection with the people I'm filming. That is very important for me. Of course, sometimes when is action happening, you don't have time to build that connection. Like for Jimmy Osa, he was there and I arrived and I start to film.
Yeah.
It was happening. That was the moment. But in general, and sometimes, you know, I know when it's time to stop recording. You know, I'm not someone that, again, film a lot. Not only I'm not rushing a lot, but I don't film a lot. Like, for example, I don't know how much for Mosul, I spent maybe 4 months on the ground, shooting mostly run and gun actuality action. And I think I have maybe James 30 hours, 40 hours of rushes.
Yeah.
So it's not much. I think we have probably less in the Philippines.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. That's very surprising. It's surprising on one hand as a doc filmmaker, but also seeing the way that you shot on the president's orders, I'm not surprised. I get it. It's very, very well thought out, the shot construction.
And actually, the way we did it with this film, which is different from Oso, is I was recording sound, so I would kind of keep rolling.
Yeah.
So Olivier.
Some of the sound clips got in there once the camera was shut off.
Right. Well, that's
exactly.
Yeah. But you know, so I'd be curious to know how many hours actually of rushes, including the sound
of audio.
Know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Olivier has like an incredible eye for like the shots that make up a sequence. So, you know, it makes the edit process like a dream.
The police have faced mounting criticism and accusations of corruption.
Pamaging presidente si Duterte. Tapos, sumito na siya sa pagda-drugs. Alam namin na kasali siya sa drug watch list.
President Duterte! You deliberately put in place a permission structure for mass murder!
Talked a bit about obviously the access that you guys have with the police force there in the town. Let's talk a little bit about, if we could, the access to the gang that you have access to. I mean, they must have known you were also filming the police, right? So again, building up trust here is tantamount. It's critical here for the documentary. How did you get in with the gang, knowing the type of film that you were shooting and that you were also working with the police? And did each other know that you were filming one another? Did the gang know? Did the police know? How did that work?
Yeah, so with the family, we saw the clip of the CCTV footage of the dad being killed. And so we then basically went with our local fixer to the street where it had happened, asked the kind of taxi drivers, you know, where this family lived. And to be honest, we really struggled to get to them for a while. They didn't really want to talk. You know, who are these guys?
Oh, yeah.
And it was actually mainly because the police no longer had a copy of the CCTV. And so we just had to keep going back to the family. And so we'd kind of almost given up on being able to film with the family
because
it was just taking so long and they were so, you know, reluctant to talk to us. But we really wanted the original CCTV. Eventually one day we went down this alley and the guy's girlfriend called us up and we went and sat there and we were talking to him about what had happened, you know, talked about the CCTV. And as the conversation went on, I think Olivia and I both got the feeling like, this guy is a great character. Uh-huh. You know, the way he talks, the way he looks, just his whole manner.
Yeah.
He's kind of got this like movie star vibe about him. And as the conversation went on, I think at the end we were like, do you maybe consider us doing a bit of filming? And he was immediately like, yeah, sure.
Wow.
And so then we were actually due to fly out the next morning and we called back to London and said, we've got to extend our trip. they gave just a completely different side of that world,
yeah.
You know. And they knew we'd film with the police. We never told the police we were filming with them
because
we didn't want to pull too much attention to it. The police knew we were filming other stuff like in the slums, but we didn't want to draw too much attention. So every time we went into their like apartment in the slum, we'd be pretty careful in terms of like carrying kit and drawing too much attention. We tried to do it, you know, secretly. So, but yeah, and they were great. You know, the access was in a way kind of easy once we had that meeting and got on with them and they wanted to tell the story of their dad, they were kind of a joy to film with, to be honest.
The film that we've been talking about is On the President's Orders. Gentlemen, how can we see the film? What is the distribution run? What's happening right now with that?
So we're playing at Hot Docs at the end of April, early May in Toronto. Then it'll be at a few other festivals which haven't been announced yet. Maybe a kind of short theatrical run in the US and UK.
Mm.
And then it'll be broadcast on PBS, BBC and RTE in the fall.
And I would be negligent not to mention the association, of course. We haven't even gotten to this, PBS Frontline. Can you tell us briefly how that happened and if you have some idea when Frontline will air it?
Sure. So we did Mosul for Frontline as well, and they've been fantastic. I've made about five or six films for them over the years, and they are just great to work with. They're serious. You know, they have the funding and the time, and they've been really supportive of me and Olivier making a film that's, you know, slightly out of the ordinary Frontline style. You know, both Mosul and On the President's Orders, there's no narration. It's not kind of talking head interviews. It's not, you know, overtly investigative. It's cinematic.
Right.
It's filmic. It's character based. And I think, you know, I think that is a sign that Frontline have ambitions to kind of move more into the, like, you know, festival world out of purely just a broadcast space. You know, they've got another film this year, For Summer, which won an award at South by Southwest. They'd had Abacus a year or two ago, which
we had Steve on the program last year.
Yeah, I mean, Steve is amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they got nominated for the Academy Award for that one.
Yeah.
So I think there's, you know, Frontline, Rainey Aronson, who runs Frontline, is very ambitious to take it in lots of different directions, whether that be podcasts or virtual reality or, you know, kind of cracking the film festival world. And that's been great for me and Olivier because, you know, our style, our taste is very much you know, more cinematic. So, and they've given us the space to do that, which is great.
Which is fantastic. We've been speaking with filmmakers James Jones and Olivier Sarbiel. I'm going to go ahead and put links, gentlemen, to your works up in the show notes for this episode, as well as other information about the work that you guys have done. Olivier and James, I could easily continue this conversation for hours. It's been amazing, and I'm eager to continue exploring your careers and seeing where more of this takes you. James, Olivier, thank you so much for being a part of the program. I really appreciate you taking the time out today.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Hey everyone, I wanted to jump on one more time and remind you that our first session of the Doc Lifer Elite Mastermind, it begins on May 7th. So we'd love to have you join our mastermind. And if you'd like to fill out an application or if you'd like to read more information about the mastermind, just head to thedocumentarylife.com/mastermind. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.